Well, I've already been told that my notes are different from last week. They're slightly different because I had more time to work on them yet, and also because I added some more things. These are not subpoints anymore. But secondly, about 90% of it's the same as last week. So if you want to play Trivial Pursuit, have at it. We'll see whether we get it all in there. But this whole idea of wisdom and marriage, I want to review with you some of the things that we went over last week, just to remind you, because I think it's good to keep it all in context. Because marriage is one of the most complicated things that you're ever going to do in your life, too. It's simple, and yet it's complicated. Life just keeps happening. And as a result, everything changes on a regular basis. And if you watch that, the way people analyze marriage, they'll talk about it. You've got the years with no children at home, and you got the years of preschool children and school age and high school and college, and then hopefully an empty nest. So that's getting rarer and rarer as time goes on. And it's very complex to do all those things, and there's the issues of physical changes and financial things that happen. It's very complex. It is one of the few things that you do for this long of a period in your life. If God gives you 80 years, you will be married longer than you work, longer than you went to school, longer than any of your hobbies. Marriage will be the biggest accomplishment of your life. At the same time, marriage tends to be one of the biggest failures in life when we don't do it wisely. But, as I said last week, there's almost no decision in life that requires more wisdom than the decision to marry, and yet today almost no decision in life is based on more foolishness than marriage. Okay? It's incredible sometimes you talk with people who resent meeting, say, 8 times in premarital counseling to get married, ready to be married, but they'll spend thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars on the wedding. And here's my unofficial rule of thumb. The more the wedding costs, the shorter the happiness or even the marriage. Because it usually reflects wrong priorities. And it's very challenging. Secondly, I wanted you to remember and not to forget that one of the aspects of biblical wisdom about marriage is don't. Don't. All right? It's not a given. It's not an automatic. It's not an essential to life. It is a choice. In that process, and marriage increases the stress in life. If you're going to be married, you can have more problems, Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And then we looked at the fact that Solomon had as much experience as anybody with marriage, several hundred times down the aisle, so to speak. And so one of his top priorities for his son was the issue of women and marriage. But mistakes in the area of marriage, it cost Solomon the favor of God and cost his son the majority of the kingdom. Now, having said all that, you notice that Solomon does not give his son a warning away from marriage, but he does encourage him to follow a different example, and he focuses then on characteristics that impact the quality of married life. And these are the things that we're focused on. It's very difficult today to get anybody to look past the superficial to the things that are really important. And so we looked last week the first three of four concerns that shape the marriage of wise people. So let's go back to this real quickly. Number one, wise people respect the exclusivity of marriage. The exclusivity of marriage. That's, you got to respect that. That's it. This is it. And this should start before you're ever married. That what you're doing before you're married is in part a reflection of the fact that one of these days you hope to be married to someone that is the exclusive person in your life that gets to experience certain things with you. Okay? You just don't go there with somebody who isn't. And exclusivity then focuses on one person, and exclusivity rejects all others. You say, I do to one, I don't to everyone else in the course of that. And again, you know, it sounds like a power trip, I know, sometimes, but I say to couples, if you understand when you are married, and they kind of go, oh, well, when's that? I said, when I say so. When I stand up there and say, I now pronounce you man and wife, that point, you're married. Not until. So keep that in mind in the things that you do, because this is exclusive. And anytime up to that point, feel free to walk out the door. Because believe me, you'd rather have all those wedding guests mad at you than to enter into a bad marriage, one that you're not committed to and not wholeheartedly into. Secondly, we looked at the fact that wise people uphold the high value of their marriage, and they see their spouse as a God thing. Okay, when you get a husband, you get a wife, again, it's focused on sons, so it talks about wives, you get favor from God. This was God's idea, marriage. And again, you know that Satan is laughing up his sleeve when we take an idea of God and we do it Satan's way. Okay, that's a huge problem. But once you're married, somebody says, I don't know, if I think I may have missed the one. Hey, let me point out the one. You see her, you see him in God's program, that is the one. Okay? It's a God thing. God's involved in this. And secondly, a spouse will determine much of the quality of your life. Okay? You can't escape this. You know, some people think that divorce will get them out. You know that the ex-husband, ex-wife shapes your life too. They will always be, in some sense, a part of your life. Okay? They just are, especially if you have children. And you can't, there is no complete do-over in this whole process. And the third thing we looked at last week is wise people major on faithfulness. Wise people major on faithfulness. This is a primary thing. Keep the focus. This is the one to whom I am faithful, and everybody else can take a hike. Many pastors have lost their marriages, their families, and their ministry because they lost track of the idea of faithfulness. Because in the end, there's one to whom you're committed, not a whole bunch of people. Okay? Especially some poor gal sitting there in your office crying her eyes out, and you feel terribly sorry for her. You want to help, you want to, you know, and she just wants to help you too. And you got to realize there's one. There's one. That's it. So tonight, we're going to look at the fourth one. This is my last main point from last week, but it's the only point for this week. So one point and you're out of here. Don't get in a hurry. It won't go quick. Wise people know good marriage is character-based. Good marriage is character-based. Now, I'm going to get in real trouble here, I'm sure, but I'm just going to say this. You know, you look at a person that you've been married to for 30 years or 40 years or whatever else. Here's one thing that I know. They don't look like they did when they were walking down the aisle. Okay? Sometimes you got less hair, sometimes you got gray hair, some, you know, whatever else. They don't look the same. They've changed. That's a part of the package. And you look at that whole thing, and you got to understand that what the world's telling you today, how do you find a spouse? Look for somebody who is hot. Right? Look to the side, you know. And that's the whole thing. Now don't get me wrong. You know, all of us really, hopefully, are into our spouses in every way and think they're really wonderful. You know, it's kind of incredible when you start to realize that there's a 60-year-old woman that can turn you on. You know, but that's a fact of life, and that's where the focus needs to be. But the thing is, you're going to change. You're going to change. And so Satan sets up this whole system now where you've got the world system saying to you, look on the outward appearance, because that's how you find somebody. And I've had Christian guys say to me, well, you know, what happened to so-and-so? Well, she wasn't hot enough. I had said that to me. You know, and if you don't believe I have self-control, just testify to you that there are no single guys that are laying dead from my hands after saying things like that. See, wisdom understands this, that when everything is said and done, character is the issue. And character, in the end, is everything. It's everything. And somebody might say, well, what is character? Well, character is what you are in your unguarded moments, those times when you're not focused on appearance, and you most clearly display the inner person of who you really are. You don't get to see that person usually dating. That person doesn't come out at a nice restaurant. That person doesn't come out in, you know, all the public stuff like that. But trust me, within a week of the wedding, it comes out. Who you really got, who this person really is. And again, talking with young couples, I'll talk to them about the fact, you understand when you're standing down there at the front, you got a basic problem. It's crowded. I said, what do you mean? I said, well, there is who the wife thinks that she is. And then there's who, or the bride, and it's who the groom thinks the bride is. And then there's who the bride really is. And then there's who the groom thinks that he is. And then there's the person that the bride thinks the groom is. And then there's the person that he really is. And you're all up there at front at once, and all of you are saying, I do, and you get the whole package. And they, what? It's very challenging. And the biggest frustration I've got about the whole dating process is it's not character-based. If you really want to know what somebody's made of, serve the Lord together. That's the best way that I know of. And do things that matter together, not things that don't matter together. Because this whole issue here comes back to character. Do you know what Americans believe? It's okay to treat the people closest to us worse than anybody else on the planet. We will not let our real, genuine character be known, especially if it's poor character, at work. We keep it covered. We don't let it happen in public engagements. But when you come home, our families get stuck with who we really are. And character is what really matters then. And so I want to remind you as we get into these specifics that Solomon was focused on his son. And every one of the wife statements, particularly the character statements, apply to the husband as well or maybe more so than the wife. You say, why more so? Because he's the head. One of the things that Christ is our example. Read 1 Peter chapter 2. He gave us an example. He lived that perfect life. And husbands, if you want to be the head of your home, you've got to not duck this one thing. You're the example. And so if you look at your wife and say, I don't like this about my wife. Good. How are you doing on it? Well, it's not my problem. She's the one that's supposed to do this. No, my friend. You're the head. So let's look at these character issues, okay? Number one is that character is reflected in grace. One of the most remarkable things about God is the concept of grace. One of the most remarkable things about people who know God is that they know how to live in grace. This is very, very, very challenging. Proverbs 11:16 is an interesting verse. A gracious woman retains honor, but ruthless men retain riches. Literally, the ruthless ones, it's just a plural, doesn't say the word men particularly there. But it lays this out. It says, listen, you get honored for grace. You get honored for grace. That's what really, people are really impressed with. Graciousness means that you operate on the basis of kindness and generosity. Ruthless means that you operate by intimidation. We have this expression today. You've heard it, right? Bridezilla. Where that happens, let me tell you, there is not a happy marriage to follow. Because when the wedding servants are gone, the husband will be the recipient of that same mindset. And you got men who are, you know, all these kinds of things at work, and everybody knows them to be very picky, very arrogant, very whatever else. It's going to come home, my friend. And here's the challenge. Notice the retaining riches. It does work, you know. Ruthlessness does work in this world. You can get money and be a jerk. But here's the thing. You can have money without grace, but you will never have honor without it. Not real honor. People are ruthless, and people that are materialistically oriented never get honor, and they never get a genuine love. And so we, as Christians, have got to stop and say, you know, I want to be a gracious person. Now, it's interesting to me to look at the Proverbs 31 woman from this standpoint. And, excuse me, all the ladies knew we had to get there eventually. But I want to say this. There ought to be some Proverbs 31 men, too. Okay? God doesn't say women are supposed to work their fingers to the bone and men are supposed to be sitting there in their recliner. But in Proverbs 31, it talks about, first of all, grace outside the family. Proverbs 31:20. She extends her hand to the poor. Yes, she reaches out her hands to the needy. Have you ever thought of your home as being an outpost of grace to those in need in the community? You know, there are a number of things that happen in the world that sometimes I think Americans just clueless about. But you know, we weren't the only ones in the Depression. right? It was worldwide. It was far worse in Germany. And out of the Depression, who came into power in Germany? Hitler. There's a whole bunch of things that he did and a lot of things that contributed to that whole process. But in the United States, we didn't have that happen. In the United States, we found that people were much better taken care of than they were in other parts of the world. And a lot of it was because the whole Christian hangover was still powerfully gripping this country. And people just felt automatically it was their responsibility to help the homeless, to help the hobos, to help the people that are out of work. If you had, you're supposed to help. And we're kind of losing that. And now we want to turn to a political game of whether in favor of welfare, against welfare, and all that kind of jazz. Okay, fine. Vote however you want there. But here's my question to you. Is your home a lighthouse of grace? Is my home a lighthouse of grace? Or is it a fortress of retaining riches? Very challenging to look at the world a little different perspective otherwise. Grace outside the family. How about grace within marriage? This is one of my favorites. Proverbs 31:11. The heart of her husband safely trusts her, so he'll have no lack of gain. It breaks my heart how often that I find that a husband and wife don't trust each other. There's waste, there's extravagance, there's a lot of waste that comes into it. I had one friend that had a wife that her mother had raised her that their recreational activity as mother and daughter was going shopping. And when she was a girl, there was nothing for them to go shopping on a Friday or a Saturday and drop $300 or $400 at the mall. And then she got married. And she couldn't do that anymore. Surprisingly enough, her mother could never understand that. And it led to all kinds of problems. Her husband didn't trust her. He couldn't trust her with money. There couldn't be cash in the home because it would be gone. She was as addicted to the shopping as anybody could have been to crack. Oh, those terrible women. Oh, give me a break, guys. You know what's a truism that's passed around among pastors? Women get a family into debt $30 at a shot. Men get a family into debt $30,000 at a shot. They go out and buy a car or a boat or whatever else. You know, yeah, they don't do it as often, but when they do it, man, it's, look out. But grace within the marriage. Their heart safely trusts, and there is no lack of gain because they both are on the same page. What they're trying to do. And not extravagant and wasteful and all those kinds of things. That's character, my friend. That's character. The grace that says, you know, I'm not just about fulfilling my own desires. I know there's something more here. Grace in child rearing. Proverbs 31:26, she opens her mouth with wisdom, and on her tongue is the law of kindness. Whew. It's challenging to be a parent by grace. You know that? It's very challenging. It's very challenging to look at a child that's not doing the right thing, and you continue to do the right thing because you want to look at the fact they're doing something wrong. You want to do something wrong back to them to punish them for the wrong thing that they're doing. There's times you need to look at them and just say, listen, I'm not doing this because you deserve it. I'm doing this because I want to be the parent, the person that I want you to be. And so I'm going to treat you with grace here. I'm going to be good to you even though you don't deserve it within this household. And that's a big challenge with kids. Have you ever thought about that? That, you know, I want my kids to grow up and understand from what they see and hear from me that I serve a God who is a God of grace. Very, very challenging. That's a huge character issue for Christians. And too many times a wife or a husband has to go way out of whack trying to balance the other person, particularly their greed for material things. Do you remember the Old Testament story when David was on the run from Solomon? And he had been protecting the people in the southern part of Israel from the Philistines. Saul, he's on the run from Saul. I hate it when I do that stuff. David's on the run from Saul, Saul was so ineffective, he was not able to really effectively contain the Philistines and protect the people. He was too busy trying to protect his throne from David, which he didn't have to do because David wasn't going to take his throne away from him. But David was doing that. One of the guys that he protected the property of was a guy by the name of Nabal. Anybody know what Nabal means? So he said, idiot, fool. Fool. It's the harshest word for fool in the Hebrew language. Now, what kind of kid do you have to be for your parents to name you Nabal? You know, I wonder if that was his nickname. Idiot. Yeah. But he was married to a woman named Abigail, and he couldn't, you know, he didn't know which side his toast was buttered on. David sent word to him saying, hey, my men are passing through your land, and we need some provisions. And the only reason Nabal had been safe from the Philistines because David had been out there fighting the battles for him. But he looked at it and said, man, you got a couple hundred men there. I can't afford to feed you. Get away. Real arrogantly. And Abigail, without his knowledge, went out and was gracious to David and his men and saved his life because David was going to kill him. And this guy is such a turkey that when he finds out about it, you remember what happened? What? He had a stroke. He died. Heart attack, stroke, just gone like that. And guys, let me tell you something. If your wife being nice to somebody will kill you, you've got a severe character problem. And guys and women, if your husband's generosity is killing you and driving you up the wall, you got a severe character problem. Now, he may not be tremendously wise about it. He could improve upon it. But grace is a part of the character of a godly person. And a couple who understands that will be freed from a lot of materialistic greed and grasping in the whole process. Character is reflected in grace in Proverbs. Secondly, character is reflected in productivity. Productivity. You know, the Protestant work ethic, there's nothing Protestant about it. It's just biblical work ethic. Try to say it again. Did you go into marriage in order to accomplish things or to sit back while somebody else worked? It's getting to be more and more now that the argument in marriage is, I do more than you do. Back and forth. And there are some times when it's true, and there needs to be some confrontation on that. But notice this, Proverbs 14:1, the wise woman builds her house, but the foolish one pulls it down with her own hands. Again, I believe you can stick husband in there too, or man. The wise man builds his house, but the foolish one pulls it down with his own hands. Are you building or you're destroying? You're almost never standing still. Are you sucking the life out of that thing or are you putting into it? The picture I often use with couples is a picture I got from a guy who wrote a book called The Myth of the Greener Grass, and the subtitle of the book is How to Affair-Proof Your Marriage. One of the things he talks about is the idea that couples have this idea that marriage is like this big gift box and they can come and take goodies out of it whenever they want. And he said that's true if they are continually going and putting goodies into it so that it's well stocked. Then in the day of need, then there's a goodie to take out. But after a while, many couples find there's nothing there because they came into the marriage just to get out of that whatever they could. And they didn't build their home. They did not build a house. Psalm 127 says, unless the Lord builds a house, they labor in vain. They can rise up early, stay up late, doesn't do any good. So it's got to be centered on the Lord. But there's also another factor here that's very important. The idea of building is not just a matter of physical labor. I would be interested to know, there's no way to check this, but how many of the nicest houses in Michigan City and along the beach change hands at the instigation of divorce? We're not talking about a physical structure here, are we? Okay. We're not talking about that. What are we talking about? Well, keep this in mind. The wise woman builds her house, but the foolish one pulls it down with her own hands. And then we go to Proverbs 24, verses 3 to 4. Through wisdom, a house is built. And by understanding, it is established. And by knowledge, the rooms are filled with all precious and pleasant riches. How do you build a house? Wisdom, understanding, knowledge, character, character. A person who is beautiful on the outside will one day not be so beautiful. Sometimes downright ugly. No offense, but, you know, a few dozen facelifts and kind of all gone. But a person who has a beauty of character just gets better and better and better looking all the way through their lives. More beautiful. And a house that is built this way is built and established and filled by the character of the couple that live there. You've known this, haven't you? Tremendous homes in little shacks. Empty rooms in huge mansions because character is absent. We got that point today. We got people that, you got a husband over here doing his thing, a wife doing over things, her thing over there. They've got enough money to buy a big enough house so they don't have to interact with each other at all. The same thing with families. Set the kid up in his room. You did wrong. Go to your room for the evening. He goes to his room. He's got television. He's got cable. He's got computer. He's got internet. He's got stereo. He's got MP3. You name it all. Hey, you want to punish him? Send yourself to his room. Leave him in the living room. It's not as nice. Listen. Productivity. Are you wisely building the house of your marriage and your family? Not that shack that keeps the rain off. Now, it's assumed here that the wife is a woman of intelligence and wisdom. It's assumed that the husband is a man of intelligence and of wisdom. You gotta use those things. Character reflected in grace. Character is reflected in productivity. Number three, character is reflected in peacemaking. Peacemaking. Now, here's men's favorite verses from Proverbs to joke about or to, you know, take a little more seriously. There's a vital concern in Proverbs in regard to men and women's relationship, and that's contention. Okay? And if you take this out of the terminology directly in the passage, it's contention. Proverbs 21:9. Better to dwell on a corner of a housetop than in a house shared with a contentious woman. But it's a real treat to live in a house with a contentious man, right? Anybody think that's true? Okay, like I said, you can flip this around. It's better to have virtually nothing, to live at the generosity of others than to enter into this kind of relationship. In Proverbs 25:24, in case you didn't get it the first time, it is better to dwell in a corner of a housetop than in a house shared with a contentious woman or a contentious man. This is terrible. This is horrible. Contention. And yet how many homes have become that's the norm? Sometimes it is really nasty, and sometimes it's just a continuous undercurrent of friction that's going on there. But in either case, this isn't the character that God wants in our home. What are godly people like? Okay, before we flip there, in the Beatitudes, who are called the children of God? Peacemakers. Somebody got it right. Matthew chapter 5. Put that up there, verse 9. Blessed are the peacemakers. They shall be called the sons of God, or the daughters of God. This is who we're supposed to be. This is how we show that God's there. But if we're the ones that are always in an argument, always bickering and everything, the one thing that we are is ungodly, above all else. And again, watch out. Gals, you go out to dinner with a guy, and he's all over the waitress and complaining about the restaurant and everything else. Run. Do not walk. Run for the exit. Call somebody. Call and come pick you up. Because you know what? Within 6 weeks of marriage, you will be the one receiving that contentious spirit. Guaranteed. And the same thing, guys, you're looking at gals. This is a huge issue. Godly people are not that way. They are peacemakers. They are peacemakers. It's what they do. One of the big questions you ask a couple who wants to get married is, when was the last time you had an argument? And they always go, oh, we don't have any arguments. Oh, baloney. The point isn't what caused you to argue. My question really leads to this. How did you resolve it? Well, he got all mad, so I gave in. Dead end. Contention is going to continue. That's not peacemaking. You follow me on that? It's a huge issue, this issue of contention. Now I want to ask you a couple of questions from Proverbs. Why might a spouse be tempted towards contention? I mean, we get married, we don't really get married to fight, do we? Well, maybe some of you do. I don't know. It seems like it sometimes. Why might they be tempted toward contention? There's several reasons. Actually, three of them we're going to draw out of Proverbs. Number one, you ready for this? Because it works. They're pragmatic. It works. They've always been able to get what they wanted through friction. It works. Again, watch out for a guy or a girl that can cross their arms, stomp their feet, pout their lip, and mom or dad will give in. Because one of these days, mom and dad aren't going to be there anymore. And guess what they're going to do with you? Throw the same tantrum. You're going to be the recipient of it. It works. Proverbs 19:13. A foolish son is the ruin of his father, and the contentions of a wife are a continual dripping. Have you ever tried to lay in bed when a faucet is dripping? Is there anybody here that can ignore that? You know, that doesn't use hearing aids. Okay, that's the point of this, isn't it? You can't ignore it. It just keeps dripping and dripping and dripping and dripping. The modern proverb is the squeaky wheel gets the grease. But you squeak long enough and somebody's going to replace that wheel, aren't they? Listen, you know, don't tell me it works. It doesn't in the long run. It doesn't build the relationship that God wants you to have. Not this contentious spirit that just keeps irritating until you get it. You know, anybody remember I can't remember the name of it now, it just went on my mind. It was the movie My Big Fat Greek Wedding. Right? The husband is the head, but the mother is the neck. She turns into everything. She knew that she could manipulate him. You know, you can laugh about that, but it ain't funny. It isn't funny. There's got to be a cooperative spirit there, not a controlling spirit that works. He does it just because it works. It's a continual dripping. You can't ignore it. It does accomplish that purpose, but nobody wants to live with it. Number two, why are you tempted towards contention? Because personal weakness toward anger. You don't understand that this is a personal weakness. This is a character weakness. Using anger to control people and to get what you want. Proverbs 21:19 is a variation of the contention verses where it says, better to dwell in the wilderness than with a contentious and angry woman. Rather face down a wild animal. You can shoot them. Right? Hey, look. Again, it's not just women. I know lots of angry men. It isn't just women. This is an epidemic in a sin-sick world. Anger is not God's way of controlling other people. Keep pointing it to you, James chapter 1, verse 19. So then, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear. Every wife said, amen. Slow to speak, slow to wrath. For the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. It does not happen. It does not happen. It does not happen. This is a huge issue. A huge issue. It's a huge battle all the way through my life. It's a battle in your life as well. A tendency toward anger is what makes you tempted towards contention because it works, but you got to get away from that. Can I give you a summary of one of the primary tools I use with couples, and maybe you take it home and work on it together, and if you want the Bible study, let me know. I'll give it to you. Four rules of communication from Philippians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4. Four rules of communication. Let me just list them off for you. Number one is be honest. Be honest. So a perverted thing, that one of the things you do in anger is you're not honest. You exaggerate. You slander. You say all kinds of things. you're not honest. Or if you're a man, you clam up and you don't say, here's what the issue is. When that happens, there can't be any communication. Number two, stay current. Stay current. When couples are having trouble, the number one problem I've got when I'm trying to give them homework is this. I tell them you need some point during the week, at least an hour, preferably about two, where you get together where the two of you can talk. You can call it a date night if you want. I've stopped using that term because the minute they hear date, they think of what everybody thinks of date here. Oh, we got to go someplace expensive for dinner. We can't afford that. No. I finally said to one couple, listen, you live just down the street from the cemetery. Go walk around the cemetery for an hour and talk. Your marriage is just about dead anyway. I don't care if it's nighttime. But every marriage that's in trouble that I talk with a couple on, the number one problem I've got is to get them to actually talk to each other. Stay current. Do not let the sun go down on your wrath. You've got to do that. Number three, attack the problem, not the person. Attack the problem, not the person. So even if the problem is the other person's problem, you still got to be the person that's there to help them with the problem. Not the person that says, this is the way you've been, this is the way you are, and this is the way you're always going to be. You louse. Attack the problem. Go at the problem. Help them. Get on their side. Come alongside. And number four, this usually takes a lot of explaining, so I won't take a whole bunch of time with it, but act rather than react. Okay? Reaction is this. Why did you do that? Because he said, she said, she did, he did, he didn't, she didn't. So I did this. That's reacting. Act. What is the right and godly thing to do in this situation? Okay? Those are just, four things that have really helped many, many couples when you finally get them to actually apply them. Be honest, stay current, attack the problem, not the person, act rather than reacting. And you can tell when people take this to heart, they come in and now they're holding hands and smiling. It's a miracle. No, it's not, but if you want to think so, so be it. Watch out, because contention often comes from this personal weakness toward anger. Anger is an excuse not to communicate, and you've got to communicate. Third one in the temptation. Why tempted towards contention? Because you've got a controlling nature. There is such a thing as a control freak. And then there's control abnormals, okay? Not quite as bad. We all like to control. Don't you feel bad? I don't know, maybe I'm just different. I don't like pain meds. I do not like feeling out of control. I have this stuff done in jaw and whatever else. Give me this prescription for Vicodin. Okay, fine, I'll put it in the shredder. Because I'm not taking that stuff. I don't like being out of control. I understand that about myself. But a controlling nature is a huge contentious issue. Proverbs 27:15. A continual dripping on a rainy day and a contentious woman are alike. Whoever restrains her restrains the wind and grasps oil with his right hand. He can't control her, but he tries. She can't control him, but that's what she's trying to do. When you go back to the fall, okay, you remember that? And there's a phrase in there that God uses with Eve that is very much misunderstood when he says, your desire is going to be for your husband. And all these men go, that's not a bad thing. That sounds pretty nice. I like that. I like her to have her desire for me. There's only one problem. If you go back one more chapter, in chapter 4 of Genesis, you find the same verb. This time it's addressed to Cain. It says, Cain, if you do right, won't you be blessed? And if you do wrong, sin is lurking at the door and its desire is to have you. The word desire means the desire to control someone else. The number one, from the fall to this day, undercurrent in marriage is two people who have an overwhelming desire to control each other. A controlling mindset. That, ladies and gentlemen, is an infallible recipe for contention and strife in that marriage all the way through trying to control. And here's what Solomon says. You can't do it any more than she can control you. And somehow, ladies and gentlemen, by the grace of God, we've got to get out of this control battle in our homes. And at some point, let this person go into the hands of God, which again is what 1 Peter is all about. Wives, you got a husband who's disciplining it to the word. Let him without a word be converted as he watches your behavior. Stop the words. Start living it. Because God's the one's going to change your heart. You can't. And you can't control him. And guys, you can't control her. And if you look at a woman and say, boy, she'd be a great woman if she's just somebody, just control her. Run, do not walk, out the door, because you don't want that relationship. Fourth thing in character, okay? Character is reflected in praise. What do you really praise about someone? Proverbs 31, 28 to 29. The Proverbs 31 woman, it says, her children rise up and call her blessed. Her husband also, and he praises her. And he says to her, many daughters have done well, but you excel them all. Now, there's no doubt about what the scripture says here. Let me give you Rumley's observation. And I haven't had anybody counter me on it yet. For whatever reason, women grow up comparing themselves to other women. And they always lose the comparison. They spend their lives. I mean, you go someplace, guys, with your wife. When you leave, your wife can tell you where she fit in the pecking order, how nicely dressed and everything else she was compared to all the other women in the room. And God help you, she feels like she was completely out of style and out of sync with everybody else. There's this comparison thing that's going on there. But notice what this man does. He looks at her and he says, you surpass them all. You say, well, he doesn't know that. All that matters is in his heart you do. In his heart you do. And ladies, let me tell you something. Men like to hear that too. You know, our character is not revealed in our ability to find fault. Anybody can do that. Any idiot can do that. Our character is reflected in our ability to find that which is praiseworthy and praise it. Philippians chapter 4. I didn't put it on the screen, but you know it, don't you? Let me turn. Why don't you turn there for a minute? Very important now, so I'll quote it correctly. There's a passage that didn't come to me this week, but it came to me just now. It's so crucial to this. Another passage, when you bring it home, it transforms the home. Philippians chapter 4 and verse 8. Finally, brethren, Philippians 4, 8. Whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, worthwhile, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there is anything, any virtue, and if there is anything what? Praiseworthy. Meditate on these things. Boy, it's transforming to a marriage. When a couple looks at each other and says, you know, I'm going to focus on the things that are praiseworthy. I'm going to find something that I'm going to praise about you. I'm going to tell you how you're better than everybody else because of this. That's what my mind's going to be focused on. But do you know what it's focused on in marriages that are in trouble? You fall short here. You fall short here. You fall short. But you do this. But you do this. But you do this. But you do this. It's one of the great challenges of counseling to say, listen, find something praiseworthy and share that with this person. It's amazing how difficult some people come out and find that. My favorite is a joke, I'm sure. I hope that didn't actually happen. The guy who assigned this to a couple, they came back in. The wife laid out about 10 things she appreciated about her husband. He turned to the husband and said, what can you praise your wife for? And he says, I can't say it. And why not? Because she'll get mad. No. I only came up with one thing. But I'm not going to tell it. She's going to get mad. No, go ahead and share it. He finally drew it out and he shared it. He says, okay, you're the one that said I had to say it. Here's my one thing I appreciate. For a fat woman, she don't sweat much. Well, that's somebody who doesn't understand. But you know, the bottom line here is, when someone doesn't know what to compliment. Now let me give you the other side of that real quickly. We're out of time. If someone compliments the wrong things, run. Okay? Oh, you have such beautiful hair. Would you please tell me where you got that hair? Was it a Walmart? Was it on the Miracle Mile? Your hair is nothing about you. That's love. Your face is so lovely. Well, wait till it falls. See if it looks the same. You had nothing to do with that. Praise the things that a person can take credit for. Praise the things that they have developed in their life that are worthwhile. Because guess what? Those things are going to get more and more and more beautiful while they look less and less and less like the models on the runway. Those are the things you're going to find yourself standing in awe of the beauty of their character 30 and 40 and 50 and 60 years from now. That's what's really going to matter. And you're going to say to your husband, to your wife, many have done well, but you excel them all. Because your beauty radiates from the inner man. Praise that. Watch out for a lack of praise. So let me review the four things that we looked at from Proverbs. I hope that you will take them to heart, be challenged by them. Number one, the wise respect the exclusivity of marriage. This is the only game in town for all of life. The wise uphold the high value of their marriage. This is precious. This is important. This is beyond anything else, including kids. Third, the wise major on faithfulness. My heart's going to be attuned to you and to you only, as long as we both shall live. And number four, the wise know that good marriage is character-based, not appearance, not anything else. It's character-based. I'd rather live in a corner of a housetop with a man or a woman of high character than a palace with the opposite. Let's pray together. Father, thank you for the wisdom of your word. I pray that we'd apply it. That we have good marriages because we have wise marriages that are populated by wise husbands and wives. We pray, Father, that you would build into our lives the things that you desire to see, not because it's simply because you desire it, but because that's what works the best. You designed us. We're looking at the owner's manual of the human race who are the products of God. These are the factory specs. And they've been marred by sin. They've been marred by a lifetime of wandering from you. They have been marred by the culture around us. They have been marred by advertising. They have been confused and obscured by all kinds of things. Bring them to the surface and to the forefront of our minds today. May we have marriages that people look on and say, wow, what you have is really special. We look at them and honestly say, yeah, it was a gift from God. We praise you for the opportunity, for the joy that you have planned in our obedience to you, and ask you to make it so in our lives. In Jesus' name, amen.